This is When Orla Met, a conversation with and about some of the leading athletes, fascinating characters, and engaging brains in sport. Kelly Southerton is a rare athlete. She's one of only five women in the history of heptathlon to have won multiple Olympic medals. A bronze medalist in Athens, Southerton finished fifth in the following games in Beijing in both the heptathlon and 4x400m relay. The relay team were awarded a bronze when both the Russian and Belarusian teams were disqualified in 2016. And having been upgraded to fourth in her individual event when the Ukraine's Lyudmila Blonska was disqualified shortly after Beijing, she finally received her third Olympic medal at the end of last year when Russia's Tatiana Chernova lost her final appeal against a doping ban. At 41 years of age and 10 years after the Olympics, which should have brought her glory, Kelly Southerton was finally a three-time Olympic medalist. Now, I've known Kelly for some time, and I've always been struck by her strong anti-doping stance, shaped by her suspicion that she had been cheated out of medals. And I wanted to catch up with her now that she had been proven right. Is there any satisfaction in finally being vindicated, or is the bitterness of those lost years too much to let go of? Can she understand any of the pressures her fellow athletes may have endured, knowing what we do now of the Russian doping system? And just how blatant was the problem in the sport not that very long ago? This is When Orla Met, Kelly Southerton. So Kelly, the last time I saw you was that very special evening at the Team GB Bowl where you finally got your heptathlon medal after 10 years. The whole crowd on their feet, standing ovation. It was a wonderful moment. I'm sure a bittersweet moment, though, for you. How do you feel about that now that you've had a bit of time to look back and reflect on it all?
Yeah, it definitely was a special moment. I think the thing is now I can put an end to my athletic career 6 years after I retired. I always felt it wasn't quite finished. And, you know, 2008, I left the Olympics really disappointed. Actually, I was in tears and it was awful. And then I never got to do another heptathlon again because injuries are struck. So I made, you know, decisions that made me really push me too hard and I got injured. So now when I look back, I've got the rightful medals that I truly deserve. Not at the time, but now. And I don't have any bitterness. I just thought, okay, this is what I am. I am now officially a three-time Olympic medalist. It isn't a gold or it isn't a silver. I'm not Olympic champion, but I've still won three Olympic medals. And that's still a massive achievement. But I still a little part of me thinking, oh, I would definitely trade for Olympic gold because my pursuit of being better is, that's obviously the competitor in me. You always want more and better. And I imagine any other athlete would bite their left arm off, right arm and both legs for all the medals I have. I've got 9 now. But like, I always, when you have that, you always want the next day, next bit. So obviously I'd love to have been a global champion, world or Olympic. It would have been fantastic. But, you know, but now I look back and think, yeah, career's all right. I've done well.
And it is a validation, really, of all of that hard work. And yeah, okay, maybe you weren't Olympic champion, world champion, but you retired thinking you're a one-time Olympic bronze medalist. And that's very different to being a three-time Olympic medalist, isn't it?
Yeah, it definitely is. And for the last 6 years, I'm an Olympic medalist. So when I now put, when people ask me to write a little CV or biography, if I'm going to do a talk, and I said I'm three-time Olympic, triple Olympic medalist, it just sounds so much better. And you know, there's been probably something nagging in the back of my head that didn't feel right, didn't sit right. I wasn't comfortable just being that. You know, I'm quite humble about, I think, my achievements. I don't shout out that I am Olympic medalist, this and that and the other. I think, but now at the moment I will do because I've missed out on that opportunity of 10 years not being able to say it. And I think it would have had a different, I would have had a different process going into 2012. I think I probably would have competed there. I don't think I would have been as injured. I would have made different decisions, life and career choices after Beijing. I was so disappointed. So right now, I feel comforted that I've got what I deserve. Like I said, but still a bit of me. Damn it. I could have won gold in 08 if I hadn't had the lead up to that and I wasn't injured. But like, I did what I did and I got what I got. So, you know, you have to be satisfied that. And now that is closed. So I don't think I'm due anymore. 2011, maybe we got a silver and a 4x4 at the European Indoors in Paris. Russians beat us. Maybe we'll get an upgrade. I don't know. But, you know, now that career's done. So now I can probably put that to bed properly and look forward to the next part of my life, wherever that's going.
that's the thing with doping and with being denied medals through doping. It's not just in that moment. It's not just not getting your medal ceremony on the high of competition and in front of the packed stadium. It's everything that comes afterwards, because if we look back to 2008, Olympic medals were still fairly new in Team GB and it was a successful Games. But for you to have been, as you would have been at that time, a triple Olympic medalist, would have made you stand head and shoulders above most of the other GB athletes. You are now one of only five women to have won multiple medals at Olympic heptathlons. Does that niggle away at you? Does that get at you? And do you think about the life that, the path that your life might have taken had it all panned out as it should have done at the time?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I remember seeing Rebecca Adlington when I first got into the village in Beijing, and obviously her winning her two goals. I'm like, oh my God, you've won two medals. That is amazing. And she was like, oh, I don't know. No, she won a second one. She was like, I don't know really what to do. I've won two medals. I think she was expecting one, expecting two. And we didn't have a very successful Olympics in Beijing at the time. And obviously now we're one of the most successful teams in 20, 30 years. And so, leading into London, you know, like for instance, in my event, Jess was always going to be the poster girl.
Jess Ennis Hill.
Yeah, Jess Ennis Hill. She would have always been the poster girl, and that's fine. You know, I know where my limitations are. I was getting to the end, and she was zooming past. But what would have been really nice if we would have gone there together, and I would have been part of her winning that gold medal. I always think that would have been an amazing experience, because I was in Sky Studios commentating on it, and I was a little bit upset. I'm like, oh my God, I should be there. And I was upset more for me not being part of it. And the decisions that I made, and my support team, we made completely different decisions. We got rid of people, we employed people, our performance director got sacked.
I would have gone because you thought you finished fifth.
Yeah, I thought you finished fifth, and I was fourth in it. And then so I got upgraded to fourth within 2 days, because Ludmila Blonska got a second ban, a second positive. But yeah, the decisions that you make from that going forward ultimately are from only coming fourth and fifth in a 4x4. So, you know, I decided I wasn't going to do heptathlon the following year. I was just going to long jump. But we decided to heptathlon. That's when I got injured. We pushed it too far. And then realised that was my last. I didn't know at the time that would ever be my last heptathlon. Then I got a back injury. And I had to make a decision. What do I have to do to get to 2012? The sponsorship money. I lost my funding, my night contract. You know, all that. And instead, I probably would have been, like you say, lauded into going to 2012. Not maybe the poster girl, but one of the senior athletes going in for their last games at a home Olympics. I probably would have, you know, got a lot more attention from being a senior, elderly athlete.
Not but, quite elderly.
But I would have been 35, so I would have been one of the older members of the team, and it would have been a nice send-off, but I didn't get that opportunity just because what happened at that Games and the decisions made after. So, you know, now I've got a different, now I'm looking forward, I've got a different story to tell now. And it's, you know, there's bitterness, there's anger, disappointment, but also there's like, I've actually got what I should have, because there's plenty of athletes. We can go back to someone like Sharon Davis, who probably should be Olympic champion from 1980, I think. You know, she's never really going to get that medal. And there's athletes like her who knew there was doping going on and being cheated by doping in various sports that, right, probably finish fourth or fifth or even third and second, but never gonna, who should probably be Olympic champion or be a medalist, but they're never ever gonna get the opportunity. So I'm thankful I've got that opportunity and those people got caught.
And you're in a really good place now, and that's wonderful to see and it's wonderful to hear. How difficult have those 10 years been? How frustrating have they been for you, and how big of a process has it been to get to this place?
Yeah, I mean, not going to home Olympics was earth-shattering. I didn't enjoy the experience at all. I don't care what anything. Yes, I was part of it. I didn't really want to be part of it. My heart wasn't there. My head was there for financial reasons, but my heart wasn't there because it was hurting me because I wanted to be there. And so on. So, you know, I didn't know where my career would be or what I would do. And I think there probably would have been slightly more opportunities post-London if I'd gone to London and finished on a high. Because I potentially could have maybe sneaked a medal there. Who knows? I don't know. Then I would have been four times. That would have been really... so robbed of that opportunity of attempting to try. So now I just think, what can I do to prevent this or ensure people in sport don't go through this again? And obviously in recent times, in the last couple of weeks, with the the Russian wildest, what I call a scandal, is happening. I just think that there needs to be change and positive change. No one's naive in sport to think cheating's never going to change or stop. You're always going to get people who want to cheat. And it's about how can we make it different for the clean athletes? How can we push them? How can we have different penalties for countries, athletes, sports? I don't know the answer, but it's something I'm willing to make it my vocation until, you know, it's kind of, there's a plan. So there's a lot of frustration still, but in a different way. I'm not frustrated about not getting my medals. I'm frustrated about our system that's someone like WADA, for instance, is putting clean athletes and clean sport in. That's what I'm disappointed at, and I want now to take that forward and do something with it.
I want to talk about WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, and their recent decision with re-accepting the Russian Federation in a little bit. But first, I want to take you back to the start, really. I want to hear how you got into athletics and what made you fall in love with it all those years ago. What stage did you have a suspicion that maybe other people were taking more suspicious means to improve? At what stage did you think, maybe this isn't quite as clean as we all think it is when we come into it as kids?
The first thing I really about doping, especially in my event, heptathlon, was Ludmila Blonska got banned in 2003 for her first offence. And then she'd gone to the World University Games in 2005. There's something about her. She didn't care that she'd had a two-year ban. And actually now she was performing as well as she was when she was caught. So leading from 05 and 06, 07 and 08, I could just see her performances getting better and better before, as they were even more when she got caught back in 2003. And in 2007, when she pushed Kluft all the way at the World Champs and came second, I just think, how is this girl doing it? This is not right. It's something not right. And a lot of people thought I was bitter for coming third. I wasn't bitter, I just knew that this girl was cheating. So in 2007, when Blonska came second and beat me, in the mix zone going through, I spoke up about my displeasure of her being in the competition. And I got ridiculed by some of the media by saying, I'm a bit, why are you choosing to speak out now? You know, you're not bitter because you come third, not second, and she's beating you. I said, no, because I got a suspicion she's cheating.
And then that was quite brave to say at the time.
Yeah.
And to say it on national television, live television, I think it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I can't remember. I just remember them going after speaking to the BBC, and then you go all the way through and then speaking to the written press. I was just saying that's how I feel. And I think at the time, the doctor in charge of Arnie Blomqvist, he said I was brave to speak out and we need more athletes to speak out. But of course, nobody does speak out. They don't want to. The World Championships in 2008 indoors in Valencia in Spain, there was Ludmila Blonska was there, and her husband's her coach, I think, but he was there, and he would give her things through the, he was in the coaching stands and she's on the track and you're not allowed to pass stuff unless you get an official to do it, but he was throwing her tissues, but they weren't just tissues, they were going like bullets, so there was something suspicious going on there. And she had a terrible World Champs where she fell before the line in the 800. So there was the same things happening again with Blonska and Chernova, and they were doing,
and these are the two athletes, of course, who have been banned.
So
since
in the long, they were passing stuff to each other. We had a combined event room, which is the end of the 100 metres, and while we come out the combined event room to each event, we walk past, the coaches are allowed in there, her coach would then pass Ludmila Blonska something, handed her tissue, we all saw it. Subsequently something was left at the long jump, and it was a bottle, like a vial, with like, I know it sounds really like archaic, but it was like a like poison sign. So it was really weird. And there was another one. So I handed that to our team management, who then, so I think subsequently would have given it, obviously, to IWF, who was in charge, or IOC, whoever was running the track at the time. And then 2 days later, she's banned. She fails a drugs test.
So your suspicions were right at that time, but it seems like it was a very blatant way to be trying to dope. I mean, they were clearly quite complacent.
Yeah, I think, I remember drugs testing at the Olympics. They did the top five. I think it's quite unusual to do top five. They definitely usually do one to four and then one random. And obviously the random, it was me. And when you get picked up at the end of your event, you get a little like an attaché, a little person, a person who will look after you if you're not able to go straight away to doping, if you've got to warm down, for instance. So, for instance, we went into the doping room and then we all wanted to go and warm down, and all of us did it together or separately. But Blonska was running away from her attaché, so she was always, she was never there, and the girl had to keep running after her. And I think there was a bit of a panic. And, you know, looking back, it probably was a panic. She probably thought, crikey, you know, well, if you're going to be in a medal position at the Olympics, you're going to get tested, so come on. Like, maybe she thought, something's going to happen. But I just remember Chernova, Dubrinska and Blutza sitting there all, like, looking petrified, absolutely petrified. And it would have been me and Hailey's Fountain, the American, who subsequently finished third and second. We're sitting there just chatting and having fun, and there were some British anti-doping women in there. Actually, the lady who usually comes and tests me at home, she was there. So it was just talking. It was quite relaxed and like, yeah, we've done our warm down. What are you going to do next?
And so this is after the 2008
event. Yeah, heptathlon. So we're sitting in the room. It's very, very busy doping. Really, really busy. I think then Usain Bolt came through because he just won the 100, so the 100 boys were coming through, so it was just rammed full of people. But there were three people who looked petrified to me, like, oh my god, why are we in here? Like, why are you in here? Because you've all won medals. So apart from Chernova, who was fourth. But it was just a funny experience. And you just, like, now you look back, they look like that because they had something to hide. Obviously, you can't really say that about Dubrincka because she's never failed a drugs test, but the other two definitely look like they didn't want to be there. If you've got nothing to hide, you don't mind being given drugs, you know, urine and blood. It's not a problem. You just get on and do it. It's part of the job. Yeah, so they're my experiences. And I've been to tracks where I've seen vials or stuff that's been in needles in toilets, but you don't know where that's come from. Who's done that? You just see it. Crikey. So, but it wasn't until 2005, 2006 that I really thought about doping in my sport. Yeah, otherwise I didn't think about it. And nowadays, when I even watch my sport, there's always, and when you see an amazing performance, whoever it is, there's always a doubt in your mind about, is that a true performance? And I hate thinking like that because I never used to think about that. Though when I was competing, I didn't actually think necessarily about anybody, am I competing against anybody who's cheating? I didn't think that because that would just overwhelm you and it would take away from your performance. So I tried not to think about. No, I tried. I didn't think about it at all until it was done.
So when you realised then that doping was going on in your sport, however endemic or however rare the cases, was there ever a period of turmoil within you? Did you ever have that dilemma thinking, if everybody else is at it, maybe that's what I need to do to be able to compete at the top level and become Olympic champion or become world champion?
Never, never, ever, ever thought enter my mind. It's like, I would think, when these people, well, how do these people get it? Where they, no one's ever approached me, no one's ever asked me, I do honestly think you have to seek it, because nobody came up to me and go, Kelly, your javelin's absolutely crap and you could probably win medals better than you are doing. To take some drugs, I would have been a prime candidate because I was always the bridesmaid and the fifth bridesmaid of football. Like, nobody, I don't know where, you have to seek it. So I'm thinking, I'm not interested. It wasn't something that I was interested in. Never entered my mind. I mean, I would have been a dead giveaway if I was taking drugs because the jab gone 50 metres. I'm like, yeah, something's happening. You know, I'm still throwing 30 metres. So something would have, you know, I would have gone from matching Clifton beating her if I'd have thrown what she was throwing in the javelin. Never entered my mind. I don't know. No. I think I've got too much integrity. I've got my morals, moral compass is too high.
Can you imagine then what your reaction might have been if somebody had done that? Because if we're to believe the stories from Russia, for example, of state-sponsored doping, it would seem that that's exactly what happens, that athletes are offered these drugs and that they don't necessarily need to seek them out. Can you imagine what your reaction might have been had that been the case? Would that have been a more difficult dilemma?
Well, I suppose, no, not really. I mean, I remember having a conversation, I was in a training camp in South Africa, and we said, you know, with testosterone, if some women have a lower level of testosterone, and if you could boost your testosterone up to the level that's still legal, would you do it? And is that cheating? But you're just putting stuff in your body that some women have anyway. And I'd go, oh, it is, it's a dilemma, isn't it? Something like that, that's naturally occurring anyway, but you're boosting it. How is that any different to boosting your creatine or your vitamin levels, your mineral levels? How is that cheating? So we had a discussion about it. And some of us said we would think about it, but not necessarily do it. We'll think about the consequences. But if it's not cheating and you're not caught, because obviously there's no blood passports then, so there was no measure, would you do it? And I think some people, well, maybe we would. If it's not really cheating, is it? But it is it. But it's a moral cheat because you know what you're doing. But if you're within the levels, is that cheating? So we had a discussion like that, and it's if my governor, if my sport had said to me, no, I don't know. I said, if you're forced to do it, I see. I understand the dilemma that most of athletes, Russian athletes, might have been. Well, if you don't take this, we'll just take another person, and they're going to earn more money, and they're going to feed their family. So I understand. You know, that's those kind of dilemmas. They're pressured and forced into it. So I get it. But you still got a choice, and I don't think I'd be able to live with myself. I wouldn't have to be able to have that conversation now. I don't think I'd be so happy about receiving a medal. I would know that I didn't do it the right way.
So do you have sympathy for athletes in any way who maybe did find themselves in that situation whereby they were pressured by their coach, by their federation, by the government, if that had been the case?
Yeah.
And little alternative?
Yeah, I do. And I think probably some of them were taking stuff they didn't realise they were taking, you know. So they could have been saying, I hit the doctor, the team doctor, here's your vitamin supplements. We've all had it. Or have a shot of B12, or, you know, you're low on iron. Here's this iron injection. And they go, okay, yeah, have it. And you sign on the form, think you're only getting an eye injection. Now you don't know what's going in, do you? You don't. You put your faith and your trust into somebody. So they could have unwillingly tested, and that's why maybe some of them are so, I didn't cheat. So I do feel for them. I do feel I do feel sympathy for them. I've never been in that situation, but I do feel a level of sympathy for them, for sure, yeah. Because some of them probably were put in situations that they couldn't get out of because they didn't know, maybe. You know, yeah.
So do you see cheating then as being a black and white issue, or more of a grey area? And I mean that in the sense that you're saying that a moral dilemma is much more difficult than a black and white rule-breaking issue. Do you think that moral cheating is as bad as doping, or...?
I think a moral dilemma is just as... if you're thinking about it, but I think there's that sports people all around the world who've probably thought about it, but not done it. Don't cheating isn't black and white. I've been sitting on an anti-doping board, so there's different levels. People are pressured, people are forced, people do make genuine mistakes, but ultimately the stuff is in your system, so you have to pay some kind of penalty. But there are different levels. There's the, you know, I'm sure Dwayne knows, he seeked out and did it and got it, and he put his hands up.
Dwayne Chambers.
He put his hands up. So I have actually more respect for him because he puts his hands up, said I did cheat because I needed to beat the best. I get that. But you don't get anybody else like that. And they don't put their hands up and say, I needed to be better, so I cheated. So I think he had a moral dilemma probably, but he wanted to be the best in the world. So he took that, well, he just took a wrong, he took the wrong turn. But there's so many different stories and penalties. Not everyone should be judged by the same set of laws. There's a lot of laws, but there should be, like, there's one law and there's loads of different A, B, C, D, all the way to Z. There's, it could apply to different, it's applying to the circumstances at the time, because every cheating in doping is different. It's not the same. There's different set of circumstances, why, how it got there. So it isn't just black and white, and I wish people would understand that. So I didn't understand that before, but once I sat on this commission for 6 years, I understood why and how. And, you know, people do make genuine mistakes. People do take supplements and didn't check all the ingredients, and it is a harmless mistake. And there are people that seek out and pay thousands and thousands of pounds and inject themselves to be better. And there's governments and sports that run a program to enhance their athletes with or without their knowledge.
So you think some kinds of doping are worse than others then?
Yes, for sure.
And should have harsher penalties?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, for instance, like Russia, they've had how many athletes banned? Now, if an athlete gets banned once, they get a 2-year ban. And if they get caught a second time, it's a lifetime ban, or 4 or 2, and or it's a lifetime, second offence off. Now, Russia have had a million... an exaggeration, probably hundreds of doping violations as a country, and they only really paying the price for 3 years. So really that country should be paying a price until they rectify their wrongs and show remorse and actually have a moral compass. They don't have one, and I think that's what gets everybody. So they should put, if letter to the law, they should never be competing again as a country.
Which brings us to the current situation. And the Russian Federation were banned as a nation from the Rio Olympic Games. They could compete individually on certain case-by-case scenarios, but the World Anti-Doping Agency voted recently to reinstate the Russian Olympic Federation, even though they have not met all the criteria that were set down in order for them to be readmitted. You've written an article about this. You've been vocal about it, but share your thoughts, if you will, as to why you think that they shouldn't be readmitted. Because if we don't trust WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, who can we trust?
Yeah, well, that's a very good point. I don't trust them as an organisation to help clean sport be clean. Russia have not been remorseful really in any way, shape or form. They had a roadmap, they had conditions and they had to be compliant. They've missed two of them, they're not compliant. But hey-ho, they've compromised with WADA, or WADA have compromised with Russia. Either way, they've cahooted and they're let off. And they've got 3 months to meet certain other conditions before, I think it's December 31st, whether they're fully reinstated or not. So I see it as WADA are even trying to trip up Russia, because they're never going to make those conditions. Or they're just literally, pardon my French, taking the piss. They're just like, Russia have really a laughing on the other side of their faces at this. And when WADA set up that roadmap for Russia, they had to hit every target and they haven't. So why wouldn't you still allow them time to try and hit that instead of reinstating them and then giving them more time? Surely it should be the other way around. And for me, that's just a lack of poor leadership. You know, I'm sorry. I think people are starting to realise the organisation isn't fit for purpose. I think the president, Sir Craig Reedy, needs to relook at his organisation. Actually, does the organisation need to relook at him? Should WADA now, should we now set up another independent organisation that's not necessarily going to be as independent, but people who've got integrity and got the right cause and values of what sport should be? Like I said before, we're not naive to think that sport's always going to be clean. There's always going to be people and organisations and sports who will cheat. That's just natural. The penalties just need to be harder and harsher. And people be clear. So the rules need to be black and white and clear. However, obviously each circumstance is going to be grey, because sometimes you've got to, I don't know whether you've fit the crime to the law or the law to the crime, if that makes sense, letter of the law. But yeah, I just don't think the organisation's fit for purpose, and I was vocal about it recently on Twitter. I think it's poor leadership, really, really poor leadership. I think now Russia they need guidelines and guidance to come back. I'm not sure if you think they're never going to be in sport again, but they need to do things the right way, otherwise it'll just happen again.
Is there an argument, though, as you say, British athletes are not whiter than white. We can't live under that naive assumption. Other European countries might think, oh, well, we've got our house in order. North America, Australia. Is there a danger of pointing to Russia and saying, well, that's where the problem is. That's what we need to sort out. Everything else is fine. But Russia being a bit of a distraction from a global doping problem.
Well, in athletics, we've got the athlete integrity unit that IWF set up independently, so we're more targeting areas of our sport that, you know, doping, like Kenya, there's Turkey, some North Africa, other countries and individuals. So we're trying to do the right thing, we are doing the right thing. It's having an impact. And I don't think right now I'm pointing a finger at Russia, I'm pointing a finger at WADA. They've allowed this to happen. And even the IOC, like the Athletes Commission, voted with WADA. That means the IOC is in cahoots with WADA, allowing Russia to come back in. Now, I think Russia should be allowed back in once they've hit all the criteria and they're compliant. Until that day, they should not be let in. So, because then I do understand the athletes and the sports there are going to suffer a lot, and there's a lot of genuine athletes there and sports people who are missing out, and I feel for them, because I don't know how I would feel. But those athletes should be it's probably harder for them than us. They need to look backwards, inwards, and think, why is our country allowing this to happen to us? And they should be fighting within the inside and we're fighting from the outside. Because it must be difficult in Russia to an athlete to speak out about your government. You don't know what's going to happen. It's hard enough for us to speak out about the Russian Federation. But the athletes inside need to look around and say, this is what's happening to our sport and this is what's going to happen. You know, if our country doesn't get this right, we might not be in Tokyo 2020. Because I'd like them to be in Tokyo 2020. But it's got to be done in the right way. And at the moment, WADA have let everyone down. WADA are to blame. They set the roadmap. They've allowed a country that aren't fully compliant. And it's there. They are ultimately responsible. Ultimately, they're responsible. And the person who runs that is responsible.
So what about the age-old argument that people say, especially when it comes to track and field, for whatever reason it seems to track this argument, why not just let them all dope? Let them all take whatever they want and let's just see who's the quickest, and then everybody knows that it's a level playing field to a certain extent and nobody's under any illusions and then nobody's disappointed anymore.
Yeah, but it'll just become money because money will buy you better drugs, won't it? So there's some countries have more money than others. And all the poorer nations that don't have that doesn't have a lot of funding. Even some of the African nations who have, you know, a million endurance runners, they're not very rich countries. So it'll just become about money. And
then there are a lot of sports that are about money anyway. If we look at, for example, track cycling, you know, if you've got the best equipment, you've got a much better chance to win an Olympic gold medal than an athlete from an African nation without much money.
Yeah.
So there's an argument that a lot of elite sport, even if it's not professional, is about money anyway.
But with track and field, you're not relying on equipment, you're relying on yourself. So I can understand, with anything to do with any equipment that you need, whether it's horses, cars, bikes, you know, that money is invested in the research and innovation of that technology. When track and field, you just need to run. It's all about yourself and it's all about how your coach gets the best out of you. Yes, there's an element of money, you know, medical and going away and getting some kit, but literally,
and paying the best coaches and nutritionists.
You don't need all that. As long as you've got your coach, and most coaches probably in this world don't get paid. They voluntarily do it, many of them. If everyone allowed to take drugs, it'd still be a money thing. And it'll just be ridiculous. The bigger countries will have all the money. It'll be the Americans will have more money. The American athletes necessarily won't have more money. It'll be the people with the most money. I don't know how much it would take to be all drugged up and running the fastest. It must take thousands and thousands because you'll need a doctor, a pharmacist. Well, you probably wouldn't need a pharmacist anymore. You don't need to know your levels if it's all a level playing field and anyone can take whatever they want. It would be quite interesting to watch the spectator sport and it would probably be a bit weird, but it still wouldn't be a fair playing level field. There'd always be someone who's got something better than someone else, a purer substance, because you've paid for a pharmacist to get it to what the grade that you need it. I sound like I know too much. I'm just brainstorming, yeah. So it would never be a level playing field. It'll be ugly as well. It'd be horrendous.
And what do you think about the flip side? You said about this debate that you'd had as to whether or not female athletes with a lower than normal level of testosterone should be allowed to boost it to get to a more general level. What about the flip of that? And we look at the likes of Caster Semenya and athletes who are deemed to have too much testosterone for what is normal, in inverted commas, for a woman. Do you think they should be forced to unnaturally and artificially lower their testosterone levels?
No, I don't agree with it. I'm one of the ones who I think it's unnatural. Like, I'm 5'10", and I've competed against, say, Jess Ennis Hill is 5'5½", so she's nearly half a foot smaller than me. So, you know, like, but she's better than me, even though she's smaller. Usain Bolt is 6'6" or whatever he is, and there's sprinters who are 5'10". But he's got a greater advantage, for instance, because his stride length's greater and he can build more muscle mass. So that's what he brings to the table. Someone like Jess, for instance, she's got an amazing mental capacity and ability to put her foot on the floor and do something with it. That's what you bring to the table. Tall height, and it's like saying, oh, if you're over 1.80 meters in the high jump, tall girls, you can't high jump because you're going to have an advantage. Because there's like people like LeBlanca Vlasic who are like 1.93 meters and 1.94 meters. They've already got 15, 20 centimetres advantage on somebody.
Just natural selection.
It's natural selection. I'm a massive supporter of Caster Semenya and her cause.
Do you have a realistic ambition for a clean sport? I mean, you say that people will always want to cheat. It's part of human nature to try to get an edge. Do you realistically think that we can, by and large, rid the sporting world, or to narrow it down to your particular field, track and field? Can we rid it of doping, or is this just going to be the never-ending, ongoing scourge of elite sport, or amateur sport for that matter?
No, I don't think we ever. And I think we're kind of naive to the fact that there are sports who have a great deal of more money in than track and field. like team sports. There's got to be some element of dope in there, and it just never gets brought to the table.
Are there sports that are too big to bring down then?
Yeah, probably. I wouldn't be. There's got to be something in football. Why? What? It's ridiculous. So I just think people will cheat, whatever way. You don't. People cheat on the football field, don't they? They dive and they trip and they pretend that they've been smacked in the face. Oh, and it's like a crescendo, and they die. Like they're dying to the floor, but they're all right 2 seconds later. There's all an element of cheating. Yeah, people are going to cheat. They're going to cheat regardless. But you just don't want it to be on the same scale as what you've seen over the last, well, I'd say the last 10 years, the last 20, 30, 40 years that we've seen in our sport through the East Germans and Russian scandal. It's probably been continuing on all the way through those decades. No, it's never going to stop. You need harsh penalties. Like, you're not going to stop people killing each other, are you? You're not going to stop people stealing on everyday life and in general world. You don't stop people. If there's a death penalty, people will still kill people if they're caught. And in America, they still do it. It's not, the penalties aren't hard. You can't get any harsher than losing your own life or, you know, eye for an eye. It's, maybe there's a bit less, I don't know. You're never going to stop people's... When we go back to the moral compass, it's all going to turn the wrong way for some people, and they're going to make stupid decisions.
So again, to play devil's advocate, if it's entertaining, does it matter?
This is what I get. I'm a football fan, and I think it does happen in football. I don't think fans care. I mean, I probably do care a bit more because I come from that environment. Definitely do care, but I don't think necessarily people. When it comes to track and field, pure sport, and things like probably cycling and athletics and swimming and those sports, they look at that as more pure, and I think because it's got the Olympic tag, and that means a lot for that sport. It's usually not all cycling, but it's the pinnacle for those sports. I think people stop trusting those performances. The general public, you just look at the comments from sport, oh yeah, but they were clean, and these are people who have nothing to do with sport, and the general public make that, but. And so they probably lose interest in watching us, where they probably watch football and probably watch rugby, or they probably watch ice hockey or the NFL or baseball, that happily. No, and it probably does go on there, but they don't really care. I think it's a different set of fans for each. Olympic fans, and then there's team sport fans.
So I've had this discussion actually with Jonathan Waters, who's a team leader in cycling, and he says that different sports have different purposes. They serve different purposes to their fans, and so it depends on the sport really then, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, like football, team sports are more tribal, where you come from, what you believe in, those kind of things. But Olympic sports is a collection of people come from all different areas, come together and perform, and it's usually once every 4 years really for Olympic sports, where they get showcased. And then they just get new fans, and those fans then go away and go and watch their everyday sport. Yeah, it's just a different set of fans. Our track and field fans, They might love other sports, for instance, but they're track and field fans at heart, so they'll get disheartened when they see all these doping stories, where there's some doping stories in football. People are like, it's only that, it doesn't matter, it's fine, just carry on. I think it's just the attitude of people, of those fans, rightly or wrongly. Maybe they just don't care. It's just kicking a ball. But it matters when somebody's running as fast as they possibly can in a straight line for 10 seconds.
So if you were to look back to young Kelly, little Kelly, growing up with the Isle of Wight, with her Olympic dreams and her world-beating dreams, would you advise her to take exactly the same path? Or what would you say to her, knowing everything that you know now and everything that you've been through?
I'd tell little Kelly, of 10-year-old, to keep her dream was to be world champion at 800 metres and long jump, because I thought that was the combination that I was the only person ever be able to do that. And I'd still keep your dreams, because last week I received a medal 10 years on, and there must have been little kids watching that or seeing that go, oh, mummy, why is that old lady receiving old lady receiving a medal, not at the Olympic Games? And then they would have had to explain that, and that does that put their little kid off? But if it's in their heart and they've got an inner belief and passion that they can be the best they can, I would never stop that them from having that dream. I think nowadays more kids are growing up wiser, and they understand this is what could happen, but you know, it doesn't stop you from not wanting to achieve your dream. There's cheating in any aspects of life, and people will do it regardless, and so you know, it's just a part of the experience, and you just hope they don't really get affected by it, because it is only a small percentage. Let's get this real, it isn't a massive percentage of people that are truly affected. It is a small percentage, and you, for instance, I'm just one of those small percentages being affected. I would still try and keep that dream alive for that person, because it means everything to them. You don't know where it'll take them or what influence they could have over that.
So you'd do it all over again?
Yeah, definitely. I'd like to have been a bit more successful a few years earlier, but that's part of me, who I am, my story. It's different, and everyone likes a different story. Who wants a normal plain Jane story? Yeah, I was good at sport, I was really good, and that's it, you know, booked out. I came a different way, trod a different path, and now it's taken me on the path where hopefully I can make a real big influence and difference to sport in the world from the situations I've had. So I've learned from them, and I hopefully can give that experience and knowledge back to the next generation or three going forward.
Kelly, wish you the best of luck with everything. I've no doubt whatever it is that you aim for next, you will achieve. Thank you.
What really struck me from chatting to Kelly is how much her anti-doping stance seems to have, if not mellowed, then certainly become a little more nuanced now that she's been proven right. She's obviously still strongly against any kind of cheating in sport, but there seems to be some sort of an understanding that it's not always black and white, that the grey areas can be larger and more problematic than we want to admit, which I guess is part of the problem. It was also interesting to hear her thoughts echo those of Jonathan Borters, who I spoke to in the first season, a confessed and reformed former doper in cycling. He agreed that there were some sports where the fans just don't really seem to care that much. Well, if you missed that episode, it's well worth a listen for another angle on doping in sport. And you can listen on all your usual podcast platforms right now. Coming up in the next episode of When Orla Met.
So we knew he was going to win, and people kept texting me. And even Cav, who was out the race, was texting me saying, you know, he's going to win this. I was like, yeah, it looks like he is, you know.
That's in the next episode of When Orla Met. A huge thank you to Jonathan Rowe for editing this and all the other chats in both of the series so far. We have plenty more to come, so do subscribe for free where you usually find your podcasts, and leave me a review on iTunes if you get a chance. It does actually make a difference. If you have any thoughts on what you've heard or would like to offer any suggestions for upcoming chats, then do get in touch. You can follow and contact me on Twitter and Instagram at When Orla Met.